listening to the Jackie Daily Show. Listen, I'm so excited because I have my friend Dan Morinoff in studio with me today for the first time ever, somehow. He's the executive director of the American Civil Rights Project. We are going to have a long discussion about his work at his law firm he just launched to hold companies accountable for ESG investment criteria, which is endangering pension funds, endangering your investments, your ETFs, your mutual funds. He's going to explain how the big three, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, own like 80% of the S&P, a controlling interest or a influential interest in those companies, and also major media companies, more importantly, in each other. So the banks and the financial large asset managers all tend to own each other, which is why they can walk in lockstep. This is why something like a election integrity law can pass and corporations will all in lockstep take a position. They're all getting the same sources of funding from the same circle of people because all of the banks are promiscuously occupied by the same decision makers, at least in some measure. And the question is, at what point is that collusion? Is it antitrust and in need of antitrust application to break it up? And so Dan Morinoff makes the case in the Wall Street Journal at the top of the opinion section that we should break up the ESG investing giants. He says BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street effectively control each other and their market competitors. And he goes into his work to hold accountable Starbucks. He's also, I know, done work to correct Lowe's and Coca-Cola and others. And he's steadfastly investigating to see what he can do to put a stop to things like the divestment of the U.S. oil and gas fields, which is only going to benefit their foreign competitors who are far less green and far less humanitarian and far more tyrannical. So a lot of bad things can happen when all of the banks and financial institutions bind together to jointly divest from a sector of the U.S. economy. And so no one knows more about that, I think, than Dan Morinoff. Maybe Paul Atkins, the former SEC commissioner who's been on the show. We've had a few ESG experts here. Vivek Ramaswamy, obviously, who has Strive Inc., which is the new ETF. It's very similar to BlackRock's, except it doesn't do ESG scoring. Its only concern is returns. So if you want to actually make money in the market, if that's why you're there, and it's not a charity investment for you that gets burned up by massive commission fees that they can charge for these so-called ESG investments, which are supposedly environmentally friendly and socially responsible and good governance. But you know what? I don't believe all those claims. And I've shared with you in the past articles opinions from experts explaining maybe these things aren't as green as you think they are or as diverse as you think they are. So I don't believe all the representations. That's the other problem. There is no definition legally for ESG. And so it's hard to hold anyone accountable when your pension fund manager blows your money on politics. So we'll talk about that with Dan. Then I have the governor of Alaska on the show, Mike Dunleavy. I met him this past weekend. We had dinner. He's amazing. He has so many facts on Alaska that I did not know. Very exciting LNG project going on up there that they're trying to get off the ground. They're going to bring a lot of oil online soon, which is great. The world needs more oil. He will explain why Alaska is the poster child of environmental fundraising, which only ends up halting responsible resource development. Alaska is extremely heavily regulated for its mineral extraction. I mean, it's one of the biggest agricultural states. It's one of the biggest timber states, one of the biggest rare earth mineral states. I mean, it's got it all. Alaska is a gold mine, and I'm sure that Russia is very sorry that they ever let Alaska go. You might remember from your history class that the state of Alaska was purchased for $7.2 million in something called Seward's Folly. Secretary of State Seward was the person who made this happen, and he was widely ridiculed for buying this vast open, you know, tundra, what people thought was worthless land. I mean, just most of it iced over. Turns out it is one of the most valuable pieces of land in the United States. I thought I knew how valuable Alaska is. I didn't know the half of it until I had dinner with Governor Dunleavy. So he will explain that to us and why it can be a great hope for bringing down energy prices, which means bringing down the price of everything. Nothing is more inflationary than high energy prices, except maybe war. And then I'll tell you about the railroad strike, my thoughts on it. It's a big deal and it needs to stop, or otherwise even more inflation and rolling blackouts could be coming, because railroads move things like coal that we need to fund the grid, things that our allies need as well overseas to stay alive. So let's hope that that gets resolved. And then I'm going to tell you about, oh, what next? Eating bugs. I'm sure you've seen the memes. You know, the kid who looks totally clueless, who says, the TV tells me if I send money to the government and eat bugs, it'll make the weather gooder. Right? So that's the deal now. We're all supposed to be eating insects. The World Economic Forum is rolling out video after video after video about why we have underappreciated the role of insects all this time. And we really need to start working insects into our sausage, into our diets, snack foods for the kids at school, that somehow they can help us by eating chemicals and producing substances then that we use for batteries. They've got all these short videos telling you why. You're going to love the idea of eating crickets. And you probably saw also online that we're supposed to start milking cockroaches to replace the milk from cows, because it's so much more nutritious and you're just going to love it. You know, cows are a big problem for global warming and we have to care. Before I go, Patriot Mobile, one of my favorite companies on earth. It's right here in North Texas. This is a company that will cut your phone bill if you join up with them, because they buy in bulk from the providers, sell it to you, and they give a portion of every bill you pay to charity. And when I say charity, I mean a real charity. I'm not talking about, you know, some woke nonsense, you know, funding riots across the country in the middle of the summer. Nothing like that. Nothing like that. That's not the kind of company this is. Real charities. They care about real people and protect your kids. So check them out online, Patriot Mobile. If you want to save money on your phone bill, now's a great time to switch, because I bet you inflation is taking a bite out of your family's finances. I switched to Patriot Mobile a while ago, and I've never been sorry. I noticed no difference in the quality of my service. Again, it still comes from, unfortunately, some woke companies like AT&T or Verizon, but they're not making nearly as much money off of you, and you can know a portion of your money is going to good things that you would actually be proud of. Patriot Mobile of Texas. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com, on Twitter at jackiedailyhost, Facebook and Instagram. Okay, I have on the line Governor Mike Dunleavy from Alaska, which, as you might know, is one of the most energy-rich states in the U.S., often overlooked but should not be, because really, it is a treasure. It was called Seward's Folly. People thought buying it was a big mistake. It is one of the greatest treasures of the U.S., and I had no idea how much so until I had dinner with Governor Dunleavy on Saturday. Governor, tell us what we don't know about Alaska.
Oh, well, Jackie, first of all, thanks for having me on. And it was a real pleasure to be with you and a few others and enjoyed our conversation about Alaska and Texas. So for the folks that don't understand Alaska well, I'll just give a couple little points about Alaska. So we're obviously we're up in the northwest part of North America. We are part of the United States. Sometimes people don't think that. But we're land size, we're about 2.5 times the size of Texas, to give you some idea. So if you superimpose Alaska on a map of the United States, lower 48, as we call it, the southeastern part of Alaska would touch Florida. the northern part up by Barrow would touch northern Minnesota, almost Canada, and the Aleutian Islands would extend out out into the Pacific past San Diego. So that's how large we are. We used to have four time zones prior to 1981, and we consolidated those time zones into two time zones. We have more coastline. Alaska has more coastline than the rest of the lower 48 put together. We have probably three times the fresh water of any other state.
Three times the fresh water?
Yes.
Wow.
Of any other state.
That's huge down here. Okay.
I know. It's very important now. We have probably more farmland. I know folks are going to find this difficult to believe. More farmland than other states. We have a high temperature, a record high temperature in Alaska of 100 degrees. That may surprise people. But at the same time, that's up around Fairbanks. At the same time, in the wintertime, we could have temperatures as low as 70, 75 below zero. So it's a land of extremes. We have 130 volcanoes, roughly, 30 of which are active.
130 volcanoes. 30 active volcanoes. Okay.
Yes. 30 active volcanoes. We have tremendous amounts of energy. Geothermal energy. We have the second largest tides in the world here in Alaska, in Cook Inlet by Anchorage. Enormous coal fields, enormous gas and oil fields. Back in 1989-90, we were producing 2 million barrels per day of conventional oil in our pipeline. We're down to about 500,000 now, but there's a number of plays that are going to be coming online that should increase that production somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000 to 700,000 barrels, and we're hopeful with our heavy oil research that we've been doing on polymers to lift that heavy oil out of our Kuparuk, Prudhoe, and Milne Point fields up north in the North Slope, that we can get billions of additional oil into the pipeline. We are the state with the 800-mile pipeline known as the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It's a man-made figure you can actually see from space. I mean, it's an engineering marvel, to be honest with you.
Right.
We're a small state in terms of population, Jackie, only about 700,000, and that's probably a neighborhood of Houston or a county in Texas. And that's how we look at it.
Yep.
We have more moose and bears than we do people.
Amazing.
Up here in Alaska.
Okay.
We're about 2 miles from Russia. People don't understand this. You know, when they think of Russia in the lower 48, they think about going across the Atlantic, then Europe, and then Russia. We're actually about 2 miles from Russia. As a matter of fact, we have a small island called Little Diomede, in which there is an Eskimo community on it. 2 miles away is Big Diomede, which is a Russian weather station. And in between is the international date line. And as I tell people, when you try and land on the ice to go visit Little Diomede, the American side, your final approach, you fly into tomorrow and you come back into today in just a few minutes and land. Because when you're looking over at Russia, if it's Monday in Little Diomede, it's Tuesday in Russia.
Yeah.
So we're very close to Asia. We are the northernmost state, the westernmost state, and the easternmost state, because we do have some Aleutian Islands that press across the international dateline. But we're also closer to Australia. We're so far west, we're closer to Australia than California is. And that's tough for people to get their mind around.
Amazing.
Even though we're this far north, we're that far west is really the issue.
Wow.
We have the fourth busiest air cargo airport in the world is at Ted Stevens International Airport. A lot of cargo coming in from Asia at that airport. Boy, the list goes on. Tremendous gas reserves like Texas, tremendous oil reserves, well over 30 of the world's critical and strategic metals and minerals here in Alaska. 1/7 of the country's timber resides here in Alaska.
So basically, Russia made a huge mistake when they let Alaska go. They made a huge mistake.
Well, By watching recent events, they've made a number of mistakes.
That's right.
This is one of them.
That's right. That's just one of them. Well, I know that you have plans up there to expand LNG production, which would be a lifesaver to a lot of people around the world who could use it. How's the progress on that, or what's standing in the way?
Well, very good question. And interestingly enough, Alaska was the state that pioneered LNG export for the United States back in 1969.
Wow.
We built an LNG export facility down in Cook Inlet in a little town called Nikiski. And we were sending gas over uninterrupted from 1969 to about 2007, 2006 to the Japanese. And we want to resume that relationship with gas in the North Slope. This project that we're looking at has all of its federal permits. It's hard to believe, given the environment that we work in and how difficult it is to get federal permits, but we worked hard at getting those federal permits, got all of them in 2020. We have tremendous amounts of gas. It's not tied to Henry Hub. So our gas, when we do sign a contract with buyers and the sellers, will be kind of at a static rate is the idea, with probably some cost increases for inflation over time. We have $26.3 billion in loan guarantees from the federal government to help underwrite this pipeline. It'll be about an 800-mile pipeline. It'll have a liquefaction plant, once again, down at the end of the pipeline in Nikiski, so that the gas could be taken to Asia, and that would be the main customer, especially Japan. And right now, it's getting a lot of attention, given what's happened in the world with the wars in Europe with Ukraine and Russia. But also, it's getting attention because of some policies coming out of Washington that are, to some degree, anti-carbon, oil, gas, coal.
Yeah.
So this is a project that has some real promise. And again, we're having a number of investors, buyers, and pipeline builders having conversations about this line. So we're hopeful something will come of all these discussions here, hopefully in the next couple months.
Oh, wow. Okay, 2 months. So that's fantastic.
You
said that Alaska is the poster child for environmental fundraising to halt responsible resource development. I copy that as oil and gas and probably other things too. Explain that.
So we are, as you mentioned, we were purchased from Russia by Secretary of State Seward in 1867 for $7.2 million as a storehouse of minerals and resources.
Mm-hmm.
So as I mentioned, we have the largest commercial graphite find in North America here in Alaska. We have a copper play that's valued at over $1 trillion here in Alaska. We have enormous amounts of gold, lead, zinc. My three daughters work at the largest lead zinc mine in the world, and it's in Alaska. We have 1/7 of the country's timber here in Alaska. We have billions of barrels of oil. All of these things we have, but Alaska has been treated as a national park by the federal agencies, whether it's Fish and Game, EPA, Army Corps of Engineers. There's been repeated attempts, especially in this administration under President Biden. It was a different story under President Trump. He was all about opportunity. He would always ask me what he could do for Alaska. And he made a tremendous number of doors open for Alaska. When the Biden administration came in, they began to close those doors. They began to slow down, if not halt, the permitting process. As a result, we have numerous lawsuits, unfortunately, against our own federal government. And to a great degree, I think it's not a stretch to say that we as a state are treated worse than some foreign countries are by our own federal government when it comes to producing our resources. And if you don't mind, Jackie, I would like to say something to the audience, which is very, very important, and that's this. For those that believe that if you stop resource development here in the United States and in Alaska, that if you don't drill for oil, gas, you don't mine for critical minerals, and you don't harvest timber for the appropriate uses for timber, it just goes away. It makes everything better. You don't have to worry about things. The fact of the matter is, it will drive those industries overseas. It will drive mining overseas, which it has done. It'll drive oil and gas exploration overseas, which it's done.
Mm-hmm.
It'll drive timber harvesting overseas, which it's done. And I would say that for those that see themselves as environmentalists and that care about the world, that is the worst possible thing you can do. And the reason I say that is you drive these things overseas, you drive them into locales that don't have the environmental regulations that the United States and Alaska does. You drive them over to locales in which there's child labor, that there's social justice issues, human rights issues. You drive them overseas, and oftentimes unwittingly, and maybe in some cases wittingly, to prop up dictatorships and bad actors. And so there's numerous reasons why you should never want to drive these industries overseas, and it also weakens America. So for the environmentalists that may be listening to this, driving these resources, driving these industries overseas doesn't really accomplish your stated goals. It actually does the opposite and ensures that the environment is degraded to a great degree everywhere but here in America and Alaska.
So I've only got a few minutes left. respond to this claim by some of the NGOs and environmental groups that oil and gas production in Alaska is unregulated.
That's nonsense.
Yeah.
That's nonsense. We're probably the most regulated locale, and oil and gas is probably the most regulated industry we've got up here. You won't find a drop of oil on the ground up here. We, by state law, not federal law, by state law, we never flared our gas here in Alaska. We recycle the gasket that comes up with oil back into the reserve, back into the ground. You cannot park a pickup truck on the North Slope without putting an absorbent pad underneath it. In the event there's an oil drip from your oil pan in your truck, oil spills have to be reported immediately. So, no, it's regulated, strictly regulated. But ironically, a lot of these regulations we did here in Alaska for ourselves before the federal government got involved. And so this idea that we don't care about Alaska doesn't make any sense.
No. And they also expressed concerns, as you know, about polar bears. And first of all, I've been talking about how the polar bear population has really come back. But I was shocked to learn that in Alaska, you can hunt polar bears, but only under what circumstance?
Well, you can. The only folks that can hunt polar bears in Alaska are coastal Native Alaskans, like our Eskimo folks, which, by the way, my wife is an Eskimo lady from one of the villages north of the Arctic Circle. But they're the only folks that, under federal law, can hunt polar bears. Same folks can hunt walrus and whales. These are the whale hunters. And so if you're not a member of that group, you can't hunt polar bears in Alaska.
Okay, very good. Okay, my last question. How did you meet a woman north of the Arctic Circle?
Basketball. We went to Nome, Alaska to play in a basketball tournament years ago. And my wife, before she was my wife, came down from her village to play basketball. And that's how we got to meet. And 35 years later, we're still married. We have three daughters that work in the resource extraction industry at the lead zinc mine. So,
wow.
So far, so good.
Yeah, well, congratulations on over three decades of marriage. That's tough. And so now we've learned the way you make a love connection in a state with only 700,000 people that's bigger than the continental U.S. Basketball. It's not easy to meet people in Alaska. Yes. All right. Well, I'm all out of time with Governor Mike Dunleavy of Alaska. Governor, thank you so much for coming on.
Jackie, it was great being on and great seeing you. Thank you.
Likewise. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. If you didn't catch the show last week, I had my friend Mark Morano on the show. He is the author of The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown. And this is essentially about how government authorities, whether they're state or federal or local, even here in Dallas, they will use, or internationally, more scary, they will use emergency powers in times of great panic, like, say, during a pandemic or after a terrorist attack, to expand their powers. And guess what? They're very slow to retract them. In fact, you may never get them back. You may never get them back. If you look back in history, typically it's something like a world war, for example, that will bring on the passage of an income tax. You might remember this. Right around the time of the First World War, the federal government institutes an income tax with the promise, by the way, that it would never go above 10%. Oh, they lie. Government numbers are rarely correct. And by the way, the government that makes the promise is not going to be the same government that's there 10 years later. We'll elect different people. They're not going to bind future Congresses. So they're not breaking the law. It's just not what you agreed to back then. But anyway, we passed this income tax as a perfect example. And then what happened? It just kept growing and growing and growing. And they found more and more ways to grow the government. When you feed it money, it grows. The administrative state explodes, regulating literally every aspect of your life. I'm going to make an argument. None of that would have happened without the passage of the constitutional amendment to permit a federal income tax right around the time of the First World War, and it wouldn't have happened without the First World War. Because you're in, arguably, an existential crisis, I realize we could easily argue that World War I was not an existential crisis for the U.S. However, it was for our allies. And so there you have it. We get, you know, Pandora's box open, and it never goes back. And so that's what the book is about. Again, it's called The Great Reset, Global Elites and the Permanent Lockdown. So here, I read ClimateDepot.com, which is Mark's outlet, and he has an excerpt in here from Chapter 12, quote, COVID lockdowns morph to climate lockdowns. And I've covered this before. In fact, there are scholarly articles explaining how COVID lockdown was the perfect trial run for a climate lockdown. All you need is to declare a climate emergency. Does that sound familiar? And once there's an emergency, you have to understand that's not just your president picking a word at random. That is a legal term. Emergency means I get more power. That's what it means. Every time you hear the word emergency, know more individual rights and perhaps sovereignty and perhaps federalism is being ceded out of your hands and out of your local officials and into a more centralized power like the federal government or maybe even the UN ultimately. So Mark has a photograph of three school children. I saw this online. I think they're from Alaska or from Australia. And it says school kids munch on insects as cricket snacks introduced to 1,000 schools to, quote, help save the planet from global warming, unquote. Have you heard about this? People send this stuff to me all the time about how essentially the World Economic Forum and all of their darlings, like Justin Trudeau of Canada and Macron of France and Zelensky of Ukraine, they're all on board with a green agenda. And it means eating less meat, which probably is not a coincidence that so many of our farm animals and cattle in particular have been put on the chopping block, literally, especially in Netherlands and places in Europe. There's a plan. They want you to eat crickets instead. Crickets. Insects are sources of protein, as you might have heard growing up, when you accidentally ate a bug or swallowed a bug or inhaled a bug, or someone threw it into your fast food burger. Who knows? I don't know what goes on in those places, but the point is, this is real. People are packaging insects to give to kids to replace meat, and that's supposed to be more green. And did you see the article about milking roaches? Did you see this? Yes. Milking roaches. It's so nutritious, the milk. So much better for you than a cow's milk. I guess we're supposed to keep an aquarium of roaches right by the salt and pepper shakers and just pull some out and milk them for dinner. I don't know. It's not going to happen. I'm telling you right now, it's not going to happen. Now, listen, I took a tour of Asia and two things. Number one, up on the DMZ, the people there who are over 50 eat beetles that are cooked up in a pan in like a sauce. They love it. But they were talking to us and said, hey, it's kind of nostalgic. Okay. It reminds us of the war. Okay, fine. In a time of war, yes, okay, I would eat the beetles or earthworms or whatever. But that war was a long time ago. So they were trying to feed them to us. And the boys tried it, but I wasn't having any of it. But then I went to a very nice restaurant where they actually had placards under the food to tell you what you were eating so you could know what the food was. some of it was like, was great, you know, like Orange Ruffy or rice or whatever. They served to me candied baby carp and like grasshoppers. I did not eat them. The world will never know through my eyes how they are. But the kids look like they love them. More accurately, they look like they don't know any better than to put them in their mouth. As Mark says, kids manipulated with bug-eating psyop. That means psychological operation, kids. Quote, chips are great, aren't they? And these chips are even better because I think they're better for you. Did you know that? Yeah, the way you know, mom and dad might let you have more chips. Good stuff, the little girl said. So, it's kind of sad. The kids will never know the world before. Cheetos, nachos, Red Hots, beef. It's all very upsetting. You know what? I wouldn't care if it weren't coerced. This is the issue. You know what? If people want to eat crickets, that's great. If people who are vegan fanatics would prefer crickets, actually they wouldn't, would they? That would be inhumane. They don't even believe in killing plants. Half the time, plants have feelings and nerves, I suppose. I don't care. If people want to eat crickets because they want to be green, I think that's wonderful. It should be a niche operation and someone should make a lot of money doing it. But I wouldn't feed it to my kid. Well, I guess I wouldn't stop them if they really wanted it. But these people look like they don't know any better. Okay. What would you learn in the Great Reset? Number one, our energy system is being intentionally collapsed. But you probably already figured that out. Number two, our transportation system is being intentionally collapsed and the freedom of movement stripped away. You probably already figured that out. Despite all this talk about $1 trillion for infrastructure in the U.S., do you ever notice that they never say how they're going to pay for it? It's a problem. Then, our First Amendment free speech rights are being collapsed by both government and corporate collusion. Number four, our high-yield agriculture system is being intentionally collapsed to create man-made food shortages and chaos, Mark argues. And finally, the ability to eat meat is being banned to compel us to eat lab-grown fake meat and insects. And the artificial shortages will create demand for insects. That is how they will get you to eat these things. You won't have any choice. Our betters are using the children as hand-picked ministers of propaganda to promote insect eating and pester adults to comply with the agenda, says Mark Murano. Kids now munching on chips laced with eco-friendly cricket protein made by Circle Harvest. There's always someone making money off every plan, every government-forced plan. You gotta wonder, don't you? Gotta cut to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Listen, after I did that last segment on Mark Murano and kids eating bugs, I just saw a meme. Some kid with his fingers shoved up his nose. And it says, the TV says, if I give the government money and eat bugs, it'll make the weather more gooder. Yeah. So Mark pointed out like these videos produced by the World Economic Forum. And I mean video after video after video that are there to encourage you to open your mind to the possibility of eating bugs and not beef. Like, here's an example. Insects could soon be appearing on restaurant menus in Europe, says the World Economic Forum on Twitter. Then, this chef explains why we should eat more insects. Then, these insects are turning food scraps into chemicals for batteries. That's a one minute, 12 second video. Insect farmer, it says on this guy's shirt. Then, 7 foods you can eat to save the planet. Then, Nicole Kidman eating bugs. That's the title. And there she is with what looks like chopsticks. Yes, eating bugs with her mouth open. It's, I guess, meant to influence you. Then, IKEA and WWF team up for Swedish seed balls for insects. Then, bug appetite. Then, scientists say an insect apocalypse is putting life on Earth in peril. Then, you will eat insects and bugs soon, World Economic Forum. Then, why we need to give insects the role they deserve in our diet. They can be used as a meat substitute in sausages. Next, this London insect farm is changing the way we eat. Next, this company is breeding millions of insects in the heart of, I can't tell what country that is because it cut off. These are all videos, short videos, so consistent with holding your attention. Promoted by the World Economic Forum. All you have to do is Google World Economic Forum insects, and they'll all come right up. Is this what's behind the farmer crackdown in Netherlands and elsewhere? It occurred to you, right? So that's what they had planned for everyone. It's supposed to be green. Okay, changing subjects and switching gears. You probably saw that the railroaders have been trying to strike a deal. You know, I think they can see they've got him over a barrel. Railroads are federally regulated, which means, number one, where I'm from, it's a great job to have, right? I'm from Appalachia, Ohio. What goes on there? We move coal with railroads. That's what railroads do in Appalachia. They move coal. They move other things, but they mostly move coal. And I know a lot about this. Railroaders, by way of history, were historically extremely Democrat, right? Because they were unionized and they thought they were voting their jobs. And then eventually, when the anti-coal movement really hit, people began to open their eyes. And states like West Virginia, which are extremely conservative culturally, but are packed with coal miners and railroaders, began to say, this gal, Hillary Clinton, she says she wants to destroy coal. Maybe finally we can open our minds to thinking about somebody else. So that's home for me, right? Those are my stomping grounds. I know this culture. I'm like the one person who, among Democrats and Republicans in this town, doesn't think that Joe Manchin is just the greatest thing since sliced bread. Look, I met him. He is a very kind and charming person. I'm sure he's a swell guy. But he needs to get out of the Senate because he does not match his state. He only votes conservatively about 10% of the time, and he's representing one of the most conservative states in the union. So why should everyone be hemorrhaging cash to run ads in West Virginia to beg Joe Manchin to do the right thing like 10% of the time? That's crazy. They should have like a Jim Inhofe over there. A reliable vote that we don't have to worry about every single time. There's a bill on the floor. Drives me crazy and people kiss this man's feet. It's disgusting. And I blame Republicans. Do you know he's heavily funded by Republicans? Friends of mine. Friends of mine. Wonderful people who see it very differently than I do. He's a great guy. He needs to retire. Like most of the Senate, most of them need to retire to a nursing home. But Manchin just needs to go home and do something else. So the National Mining Association issued a press release about this supposed railroad strike, saying, we strongly encourage resolution. A rail strike could create a debilitating logistics choke point for the movement of energy and materials resources essential to grid reliability and energy affordability, as well as the manufacturing sector and the energy security of our allies. Ongoing service issues continue to threaten coal deliveries, impeding the delivery of essential fuel as the utilities work to shield customers or consumers from soaring natural gas prices and build up stockpiles to ensure they have the fuel security needed for the winter. Curtailing the supply of materials essential to manufacturing will push up costs and reverse any progress made in solving the supply chain challenges driving inflation. The U.S. has abundant mined resources, but they are dependent on reliable, efficient rail services. That's for sure. I once spoke with Bob Murray, who you might remember was running one of the biggest coal companies in America. He was a very outspoken guy on politics, because it got to the point he had to be. I mean, his business was going to die if the policy didn't improve. And Mr. Murray has now passed away, which is too bad. He was a wonderful person. He told me years ago that, well, I asked him, I said, why are exports of coal not the answer to save your business? I mean, if the U.S. government wants to be hostile, that's their loss and craziness, and the grids will suffer. We'll have rolling blackouts because of it, because coal was such a big part of the grid feed and still could be. And it's always there. It is always there. It's dispatchable. You don't have to worry about whether the sun's shining or the wind's blowing to get fuel. And it's transportable. And people can't just steal it and siphon it off like they can oil or natural gas. It's really amazing. So I said, why don't you just export? The whole world needs coal. You got like over a billion people that have no reliable power. And he said the reason is because there aren't enough railroads to move the coal. He said, literally, there's a problem with capacity. We cannot get our product to the ports. That's the problem. And that was way back then, before America could even define supply chain problem, right? Long before the pandemic. So even in the best of times, we really didn't have enough rail. So yes, if the railroaders strike and actually succeed, or even what's it called when you deliberately slow down work or don't work as efficiently or whatever, it's like halfway quitting. If they decide to misbehave, it could really exacerbate problems. And if there's one problem or one person who doesn't want it right now, it's Joe Biden. Now, I doubt he would much mind after the November elections. Then, sure, you know what? Choke off the fossil fuels even more. What will he care? But for now, it is quite right. It will exacerbate massive supply chain problems and inflation. It will only make it much worse at a very bad time. So I hope this gets resolved for all of you who are bearing the brunt of inflationary prices at the grocery store and the fuel pumps. All right, to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at JackieDaily.com and on Twitter at JackieDailyHost, Facebook and Instagram. All right, so in studio, I have my friend Dan Morinoff, and he is with the American Civil Rights Project, which is somewhat new, and they are doing the toughest job right now, blazing a trail where, frankly, there is very little roadmap of any kind from the past to follow, I think, in going after what we call the ESG movement, environmental social governance criteria. I'll call it a movement by financial institutions, pension managers, and others. And what this is, as I've told you many times in the past, I call it, and Dan might disagree, basically a wokeness score for businesses. The problem is, it's not really defined. There is no legal definition of ESG, and so people can make it up as they go along, and big lenders can do things like discriminate against American oil and gas companies, or gun manufacturers, or payday lenders, or whoever they want, on the basis that they're not sufficiently ESG, or environmentally conscious, socially conscious, governance appropriate. Whatever. It's made up, okay? So from one institution to the next, from one bank to the next, they'll decide what your ESG score is. It's kind of like a social credit system. And so this has been a serious problem, not only for what it does to American oil and gas, let's say, but also, and I'm going to get into this with Dan. Remember, you saw like Georgia passes an election integrity law, and then out of nowhere comes all these corporations condemning Georgia for passing a very moderate, by the way, election integrity law that offers more time for early voting than Delaware. But they're not attacking Joe Biden's state. They're attacking Georgia. And why would a corporation care about a voting law in Georgia? Why would American Airlines, based in Dallas, Texas, care about a voting law in Georgia? And then why would all these other companies simultaneously be reading from the same talking points? I have a theory. Maybe they all have the same paymasters. Maybe they have the same investors. And maybe those investors impose ESG scores, and condemning election integrity might raise the score. Okay? If that sounds far-fetched to you, I'm going to have Dan explain it, since he's the guy actually litigating what's going on, and taking a look at these companies and saying, wait a second, are you living up to the standards that you claim you're living up to? You enunciate all these standards. Are you actually lawfully or even ethically and morally doing what you say you're going to do? Do we believe you? And how do we hold them accountable where they go astray? So, Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. So, sorry for the long introduction, but ESG is something that a lot of people have never even heard of. So you kind of have to explain what we're talking about here in the beginning for them to have a way to grasp it. For a lot of people, I think they understand it through pension funds. Like, do you, if you hold a pension, do you want your pension fund managers, who are fiduciaries, obligated to look out for your best interest, returning great returns for your investment fund, or playing politics with it and going green and losing money where they could have gone fossil fuels and made money in a time like now, is one example people can relate to. They just want returns, right? But let's go to your Wall Street Journal piece first. It's titled, Break Up the ESG Investing Giants. And I love, it's at the top of the opinion page. That is awesome. Congrats.
Thank you.
So, first of all, you're making kind of an antitrust argument. And that, too, is something that most Americans don't really grasp well. We don't talk about it much anymore. It's like Standard Oil is the first thing people will say. And that happened a long time ago, right?
AT&T, right? But I mean, yeah. That's still 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. So these are not things that are in the news frequently, but it's a really big deal. First of all, tell us who the ESG investing giants are and explain why antitrust is a problem for these three.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, at some point I should get back to a couple other things that you mentioned in the introduction. Just remind me of that,
okay.
But we can get back to it.
Sure.
Right. So there are a small number of passive investment shops, among them, the three largest are BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, which between them control, they have a controlling share of, say, the ETF market. They're really each other's only competitors in creating that kind of investment vehicle that's supposed to be market mimicking and lets.
Now, what is a controlling share? How much is that?
I'll have a better answer when we're talking about specific entities than in this sense, which is honestly one of the reasons that some of this, that kind of question is exactly why a bunch of this stuff has not been litigated.
Right.
I should also flag, this is one that I'll throw out.
Yeah.
I'm pointing this out because someone needs to bring this suit.
Yes.
This is a suit that needs to be brought by very large organizations, ideally state attorney generals.
Right.
It is not something that my relatively new, relatively small public interest law firm is capable of undertaking. We're not litigating this one. We are litigating a bunch of stuff against the spread of what I would call woke capital and its embrace of flatly illegal policies all across the American corporate world. You might see an overlap in why we were interested here and why we're drawing attention and setting off a giant flashing light, but we're not going to be filing this one. Just just to be
clear. Because you need so much resources. And so the attorneys general would have the taxpayer backing, paying for their staff, paying for their resources.
Right. I mean, you're talking about fighting in litigation, literally the three largest, the three
asset
largest
bankrolls
in the country. So probably the world. I shouldn't presume they're actually larger than every sovereign wealth fund.
Okay,
but,
fine.
In any case, right. So these three groups, they're basically the only game in town in, you know, ETF mimic marketing kinds of things. They run most of the mutual funds that are out there. There are some exceptions. Fidelity is also very, very large. It's privately held. Fidelity is actually owned and controlled primarily 49% by one family. It's the second wealthiest family in America, the Johnsons of, I think, Connecticut.
I did not know this.
Yeah. And the rest of the company is owned by their current and former employees. So Fidelity is in a different bucket, which we'll come back to. But the three of them. So there's a whole like literature out there that academics have produced over the last 5 years pointing out that since these places are constantly taking, like, normal people don't really want to make their own, often don't want to make their own investment decisions because we don't know what we're doing. So we want to put our money in some place that will, you know, put it into a passive investment fund where we don't have to tell you what to do with it and you'll just go and ideally adhere to your fiduciary obligations and make us money. That's really all we want, as you were saying. And they're the largest passive investment funds in the country. So they've taken these enormous sums of money, I think it's hundreds of billions of dollars, and they've invested them across the stock market and wherever else. What does that mean in terms of, you know, who actually is voting those shares at every corporate election?
Because
I'm not asked by Vanguard how they should vote, ever.
Right.
That doesn't happen. But
me,
you know,
neither.
That doesn't mean that they're not voting. They are.
Yeah.
And this is this raises some questions. How are they deciding how to vote, right? And then we're rolling into what the ESG agenda is that, you know, they've picked what they think is important, which I would say definitionally they have picked things other than value maximizing. They like to claim BlackRock. I'm getting ahead of myself for a moment now. There are 19 state attorney generals who have started to investigate BlackRock for whether what it's doing in the ESG space, specifically about the oil and gas industry, what it and its largest competitors are doing is illegal collusion to demonetize the entire industry.
Right, right.
And BlackRock has both said, we're not doing that, which is kind of funny because they brag about doing it.
Right.
And said, and we are doing it because it's value maximizing. But I don't think that that's even facially credible. If it were true that you were making value maximizing decisions, you wouldn't need a separate policy to say that's what you were doing. You would just do it and your money would go the same places. You would only craft an ESG policy if in fact you're not doing that, which is, again, this is what the AGs and BlackRock have been fighting about.
So let me like put some flesh on the bone here. An example of an ESG policy would be Exxon.
Right.
Lay out to us how you're going to commit suicide as a corporation because you are a fossil fuel company and you are one of the biggest responsible parties for carbon emissions. Therefore, we need you to scale back your core business and we need you to show us how you're going to do that. And how well you do that is a higher ESG score.
And so, when Exxon told them that's absurd, we aren't going to do it. Well, I should back up one moment before I get to that. Okay. There's this literature that's been developing over the last 5 years, flagging the fact that the big three, State Street, Vanguard, BlackRock, between them own the largest voting block of shares of, I think it's 80% of the S&P 500.
All the companies that make up the S&P 500.
Them. Right. I mean, you'll occasionally see that statistic saying it's 80% of the stock of the S&P 500. I don't think that's actually true.
I don't think
true,
that's right either, yeah.
But right. But they do have the largest voting blocks of 80% of the S&P 500.
So what we're saying earlier about controlling shares, you don't have to own 80% of the stock of a company to control or have a heavy influence on what's going to happen.
I mean, legally, the threshold is 51%. If you control 51% of the equity of a company, you make the decisions
Absolutely.
For the company.
Yeah.
But in when ownership is dispersed, you very rarely need to have 51% because
right.
most people don't vote. And since most people don't vote, actual control is achievable at something more like 20%.
Yeah.
It's hard to get economists to actually nail down what they mean there. But bear that in mind. 20% is a good rule of thumb. Okay. And this literature among the academics has honed in on the fact that since they own and control functionally all of the large industries, publicly traded companies in the country, that can mean specific things like they own and control functionally all of the major airlines.
Yeah.
And the literature's honed in on whether there actually is a demonstrable anti-competitive effect. Are they behaving like a monopolist? Are they, in fact, competing with each other, say, based on price? Or are they not? Because it's actually better for them when they own all the competitors
right.
to collude and not raise and not lower prices.
And, well, and so practically speaking, when American Airlines goes woke and says something horrific and just hacks me off, and I'm like, I can't stand that. I'm not going to fly American anymore. I'll fly Delta.
And they said the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And they said the same thing because they're owned by the same people.
Right.
It's all now, the same people, right?
So,
well, hold that thought. I got to go to break. He's
okay,
telling
please.
Me I have no choice. But Dan, keep the momentum. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with Dan Morinoff with the American Civil Rights Project, talking ESG and why we should break up a monopoly among the biggest asset managers on Earth. We'll be right back. Listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Dan Morinoff of the American Civil Rights Project. We're talking about his Wall Street Journal top of the page, opinion page article, which is titled Break Up the ESG Investing Giants. We're talking about BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, just because they're the biggest and most consequential, although there are many, many, many other financial institutions and pension fund managers and others who are practicing the same ESG scoring and criteria application. But these are those that control, by virtue of their ownership in 80% of the S&P 500 companies. And also, I'm told, about 90% of corporate, what we call corporate media. You know, enough of those shares to actually have a major influence on the behavior of those companies by laying out their ESG or environmental social governance criteria and telling them they have to meet it to get funding or to have investments put into their company, essentially, by people like you and me, where we're investing in ETFs or mutual funds or whatever we're doing. So that is where we left off. So, Dan, we were talking about, is it truly anti-competitive
right.
For these three companies to behave as they do? I'm sure they have teams of lawyers who have
right.
considered these questions.
So,
and
right. Specifically, we were talking about the existing literature that was already out there, where there are a bunch of professors, you know, people who've published actually in the Harvard and Yale law reviews. I mean, like these are not small time, you know, podunk professors who've assessed this and concluded that, in fact, yeah, there really is an anti-competitive effect in almost every industry from the same people owning the equity of all of the major competitors. What I noticed and what, you know, was the genesis of this piece was it seemed like there was an additional question that hadn't been asked, which was, okay, well, who owns them?
Right.
Like, if they're all doing the same thing, if they're all in lockstep adopting the same ESG policies, why are they all doing that at the same time? Why is it that there isn't some major player in the financial services industry that steps forward to take this chance to, you know, take a chip off the leader and step right up and make a ton of money? There is now, by the way, there's a startup
Strive.
Called Strive, and they do exist. They were founded by
Vivek Ramaswamy. He was on the show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's great. And
yeah.
I hope it works.
Me too.
But as that's, you know, out there as a thing, why did it fall to a startup to be the only people who would do this?
Right.
And as it turns out, I think there's actually a clear answer.
Okay.
And because when you look at who actually owns the big three, it is a remarkably closed circular relationship.
Incestuous, you might say.
You really could. If you started with Vanguard, Vanguard is not a publicly traded company. So we only have their representations about how they're owned. Fortunately, those are extremely clear. Vanguard tells us Vanguard is 100% owned by Vanguard's funds.
Okay.
And that sounds strange. And they play on the fact that it's not very clear what that actually means, to kind of leave the implication that this means that you or me or whoever puts their, you know, 401k into a Vanguard fund, boom, you're an owner of Vanguard. But again, I've never voted on Vanguard's board, and that's not an accident, because right. while they imply that this means that that investors actually own the company, what the structure actually is that Vanguard's board is also the board of trustees of all of Vanguard's funds. And in those two roles, Vanguard's board appoints the managers of all of those funds. And those fund managers then are the only people who have votes on Vanguard's board of directors. So you might question whether that means there's any independent voice here at all. Like, in fact, the only people who get to pick who is on the board are the people the board hires for the sake of rehiring the board. So it's difficult to imagine a more closed loop, right? But that doesn't mean that the other two of the big three don't try real hard to get close. So they are publicly traded. So they file with the SEC regularly, sworn documentation of what they own and who owns them. You have to identify anyone who owns any institutional shareholder that owns a material collection of your stock. So who does? Well, the largest owner of BlackRock, and as it turns out, of State Street, is Vanguard.
Uh-huh.
And if you pull those documents, the second largest owner of both BlackRock and State Street is BlackRock.
Uh-huh.
And the third largest owner of BlackRock is State Street.
Right.
So
we all own each other.
They own each other. And, you know, and OK, let's jump out to the rest of the financial services industry for a moment. And look, I mean, I can't tell you that I've looked up every bank, or even I could, because there are banks that aren't American and have different disclosure rules wherever they are. Hone in on this. We know what the 15 largest banks in America are. OK, State Street's one of them. Of the other 14, of the other 14, 13 of them are publicly traded American corporations, make the same filings. You can pull who owns them. And if you run through all of them, 13 of the 14 have controlling shares held by BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, or other institutional shareholders owned and controlled by BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. So, and when I say that, like for this collection, 13 of 14, the ownership shares, they span, you've got it in front of you and I'm trying to remember it, but I think it's between 24 and 45%. It's something
correct.
Like that.
Yeah. It says, with their directly controlled ownership shares ranging from about 17% to 25%, and their indirectly controlled ownership shares ranging from 24 to 45%.
Exactly. So, so all of the big three's real competitors and almost all of their hypothetical competitors are owned and controlled by each other. It's a closed loop. So that makes it real easy to understand how it's possible that the entire industry has decided to do something in lockstep, because they aren't independent actors. They're doing this together because the same people are making the decisions for all of them. And that, I argue, takes us back 100 plus years to when the antitrust laws were actually written. The one that I'm going to hone in on is called the Clayton Act. It's
yep.
from 1914. There are other ones from the 1880s, the Sherman Antitrust Act. But, you know, we wrote these to deal with small concentrations of wealth that were intertwined and owned everything and were pursuing their own agendas at the expense of the public good. That was the point. And look, the Sherman Antitrust Act is about things like collusion. It's the one the state AGs were talking about.
Yeah.
But the Clayton Antitrust Act, it's a different statute and it works differently. Section 7 of it, and specifically, doesn't ask, did you actually sit in a room and agree to do the same thing? It
right.
looks at what shares do you own? Have the shares you've acquired led to a potential negative impact on competition? That's a very different test. Now, if we were talking about in another industry, like those academics that we were talking about a little while ago, there's still a lot of fact question. There's a lot of, you know, econometrics that goes into determining, is there really an anti-competitive effect of you owning all the airlines?
Well, so let me stop you for just a second, because I have two thoughts that have come to me. And the first is this. When we talk about antitrust historically and people think about Rockefeller and Standard Oil, what they're thinking about is one man's company was so mega. I mean, it was richer than King Solomon. It was like the richest man on earth, and it was a critical core industry that fed all the rest. You're taking one person and one entity and breaking it up into many entities.
Yeah.
So the Texacos and the Chevrons and all that. Here, it's the opposite. Probably these banks started out as independent.
Well, they were.
You know, they're just banks. Well, they're what you think that you think they are, but eventually, somehow, over time, it becomes advantageous. They realize. To begin purchasing each other.
And they didn't even do so, right? Like, I mean,
how did this happen?
The ESG giants taking the passive investment dollars of millions of Americans and investing them. And look, I mean, on one level, every individual purchase they could probably justify as well. You know, why did you buy shares of JP Morgan Chase? Well, because JP Morgan Chase is one of the nation's largest banks.
Of course.
It's profitable.
Yeah.
We should own that. Oh, okay. And, you know, each of the three can make that statement, but when each of the three makes those statements, and JP Morgan Chase also has made its own decision to invest in all three of them, you know, at some point you do cross over the threshold where this is no longer just organic decisions being made by independent groups, because at this point, and let me come back to Exxon at this point. Exxon told BlackRock et al. That no, we aren't going to do that. We're an oil and gas company. So what did they do? Last year, they replaced a full, it's not a slate, it's because they don't elect their board all at once. It's more like the Senate, right? Their classes. But they replaced a class of Exxon's boards with their flunkies. I'm sure that these people are very impressive individuals, and I don't want to impugn them. But they were put on specifically to do what the ESG giants want them to do, which is to move the largest oil and gas company away from oil and gas into green energy. Oh, I mean, the transition. How nice of you.
It calls for the suicide of the core business.
It's problematic, right? So, but because they have the largest shares, and look, the three of them in their own names have the largest shares there, like everywhere else. I haven't actually pulled Exxon's numbers. I'm pretty confident that's the case. I'm quite sure that if you throw in all the other companies that they own and control directly or indirectly, that you would wind up with a number very much like this 24-45% ownership. So yeah, they can just replace that. This also tells you something about how large is the window in which any actor can do anything about this, because there are institutions that have an obvious interest in standing up to these people, but they're in the place of replacing the leadership of all of those institutions right now. So you have a closing window in which you can get rid of them. How I would describe this, we can hypothesize, you know, at what point their acquiring of each other and everything else became problematic. And we might disagree on when exactly that was, though I don't think there's any argument that it is now.
Right.
But whenever that is, I think you are in a situation an awful lot like the so-called robber barons of the Gilded Age. You really do have people whoever they may be, the decision makers of these entities acting in concert are owning and controlling everything. And if they own and control everything, that is a concentration of power, the likes of which we haven't seen in a century since, you know, the Taft administration and the original trusts. And we should be talking about, yes, breaking them up and forcing them to disinvest from each other and from their institutional competitors and potential competitors.
I'm talking with Dan Morinoff, and he's the executive director of the American Civil Rights Project. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Dan Morinoff of the American Civil Rights Project. We're talking about his opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal titled "Break Up the ESG Investing Giants." And he's talking about BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, which not only own significant shares of each other to the point they have quite a bit of control, but also they control in the same way about 80% of the Standard & Poor listed companies, and also, I am told, about 90% of the corporate media, the big media. So, Dan, I'm thinking to try to explain to people why we should care. Like, why is this dangerous? People have compared the ESG investment criteria and the small group of people who get to decide what that is and force it on everyone and every corporation to a communist social credit score. And so we understand why we wouldn't want the government to be controlling every aspect of our lives. People know I have rights. You know, as an American, you know, we all hear this 1,000 times and on television all the time. I have rights. I know my rights. Well, what are your rights against a corporation? What are your rights against a bank if they decide that they're going to control your life, make the exact same decisions, really, the government would make about the environment or environmental policy, whether or not we'll have fossil fuels or rolling blockouts, you know, or whether or not we're going to have racial quotas on boards or whatever, the kinds of things that the government in the past decided, now they're taking upon themselves to decide. So it's almost like they're becoming the government, except you don't have a constitution to bring against them. I mean, to me, that's the danger.
Sure. And, you know, you brought up specifically a great example, the movement afoot to impose race, ethnic, sex, and gender quotas on America's corporate boards. There is one state that actually passed statutes to do that, California. And by the way, the California state courts have ruled that it's unconstitutional and barred it from being enforced against anyone.
But when did that happen?
When was it enjoined?
It
was enjoined about 6 months ago.
Okay.
By a trial court in L.A., a state trial court in L.A.
Okay.
I was really surprised that there was a state trial court in L.A. But there's some like old, honest... there's some old, honest, liberal judges there who, you know, apparently actually are willing to follow the law. Good to hear. We'll see if it holds up on appeal. With that said, on the strength of that and some really not terribly related, much weaker legislation in a handful of other states, the NASDAQ actually petitioned all of our equity markets are regulated by the federal government, specifically by the SEC. And they're not allowed to change their listing requirements for who they'll actually allow to sell their shares. They're not allowed to do so unless the federal government okays the change. So NASDAQ, about a year ago, a year to a year and a half ago, had proposed that it wanted to change its listing requirements to require every listed company to disclose the race, ethnicity, sex, gender of every one of its board members, and to demonstrate, you know, they had particular thresholds in mind that the resulting boards were diverse. Is that a quota? It's an awful lot like a quota. They did have an out, and I should mention that when NASDAQ submitted this petition, they said that, or they gave every listed company a choice: either meet our criterion or give us a written statement that we will make public explaining why you couldn't. That's an interesting distinction, but it is there.
Okay.
And why did they do this? Why did NASDAQ do so? Well, they said, well, we've spoken to institutional investors, and investors want this. What did they mean by that? Well, you want to guess? Yeah, they meant Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock, listed by name in the filing.
Okay.
That's who they meant. It's the same people. And they told NASDAQ what to do. So NASDAQ then asked the SEC to do it, and the SEC approved it. So that now is the rule for NASDAQ. And there is litigation about this right now at the Fifth Circuit.
Let me stop you for just a second. One other detail people might not know if they haven't worked in government. when the SEC approves it, understand this, at the SEC or on Capitol Hill or in the White House or wherever, there tends to be a bit of a revolving door with Wall Street. So yeah. The people who are approving it, you know what? It's entirely possible that 5 years ago, they were working for a financial institution that might actually be impacted. I'm just saying that would be one hypothetical where it could actually happen and does
right.
happen a
and
lot.
I mean, my spin would be a little bit different on that, which would be that, you know, when commentators tend to say the president is trying to kill the oil and gas industry, his defenders like to say, well, what has the government done? The government hasn't done anything like that. I mean, and that's sort of true, but the government has allowed and signed off on the ESG efforts of the investors who are doing it for them. So it's not the same closed relationship, but it's not that differently closed.
The financial institutions applying the ESG criteria are like a cat's paw for the government. So it's a way of getting around the restraints that are on the government. Right. We would have all kinds of tools to push back on the government, even as big as it is, that we wouldn't have. And that isn't as obvious, right? It's not like they have to, they don't have congressional hearings and the equivalent.
It lets them pretend that, we're just letting the market do what the market wants.
Right. It's not
the market.
Right.
Because the market here is being dictated by actors who, frankly, are violating their fiduciary duties in order to pursue their own priorities. They happen to share with the government.
So here's my question. I mean, with these three firms alone, and as I said, these are only three of many, 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 mm-hmm. many firms that use ESG criteria. But let's just take the big three. How many human beings?
We don't know. That's a good question. We don't know. We don't know what their internal calculations are, other than that they're sufficiently interlocked in their ownership that whoever's deciding it for one of them is deciding it for all of them.
I mean, that's ultimately what interests me the most is how small could that circle possibly be? Yeah. And I mean, do we know that they're Americans?
I'm presumptively yes, but.
Which I mean, really, these days, who does it make any difference? I mean, you can't trust American. Americans
mean,
do not sell
about
out.
Fidelity. Fidelity, we know who it is. It's one family in Connecticut. They're Americans. They're so extraordinarily wealthy as to be utterly shielded from any repercussions of anything they ever decide to do.
Right.
But they're Americans.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Plus, if you look at, it's a kind of a different topic. I'll just say, if you look at some of the American leadership, both political parties, and some of the deals they've cut with foreign governments immediately after leaving office, I'm not sure I have confidence that being American really shields us at all or gives any assurances anymore about how people will behave. Okay, so earlier you mentioned that you would prefer the state AGs go after this.
Yeah.
As opposed to, for example, Exxon.
Right.
So because someone might ask, why wouldn't Exxon fight back? They're a big company.
Right.
So what's your answer for that?
So there are individual institutions that would have standing to bring a suit. Most of them are publicly traded companies like Exxon or Chevron who are in the midst of dealing with exactly this kind of campaign by these entities to replace their boards with people that will do what they're told. So, look, it's possible that one of them could file such a thing, but if they were going to, they would have to act very soon before, you know, the BlackRocks of the world finish replacing their leadership. And, you know, that litigation is going to take years. And it'll be appealed, and it'll be appealed again to the Supreme Court. We know that. So, you know, how much time do you have with that fuse burning before their leadership is replaced and the case is dismissed?
Well, the other thing is, Dan, that it looks to me like that what they've tried to do in the past, at least, is do the dance. They try to do the ESG dance. Mm-hmm. And at first, maybe they didn't appreciate what was happening and said, oh, okay. You know what? Run some ads on TV saying that we're doing some algae stuff. And run some ads that says we're doing a little solar over here in this community and how great we are. And point to things that prove that we actually should earn an ESG score, believing they would beat that game or they play that game and win. And then I think that by now it's painfully obvious that it doesn't matter what you do, the goalpost will be moved. The goal is not to make you more green. The goal is to end you as you exist today.
Or to replace you.
Or to replace
you. Turn you into a puppet.
Yeah.
You know, turn you into a zombie wearing a meat suit.
Yeah.
Right?
Who benefits from this? Okay, I'm quick to point out any competitor with American oil and gas. That would mean OPEC. That could mean Russia. That could mean all. There are dozens and dozens of countries that produce oil and gas. And America is capable of being the top producer of both in good times and good prices. We've proven it recently. Therefore, if you knock the biggest producer off the block, the biggest competitor, that means prices shoot up for everybody else, and pockets are lined. So
right, and if the government is simultaneously handing out money to boondoggle competitors,
yeah.
Well, it certainly is going to make it more expensive to compete with heavily government-subsidized so-called clean energy options
right.
if you don't have any access to capital.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you starve the capital from the oil patch, that's it. It's the kill shot. I've been saying this to people in oil and gas for years. It's the kill shot. And I can't tell you, Dan, how many times I've been on a teleforum or at a meeting or something, and I'm the very unpleasant person. Right? They're having these, you know, ESG is great panels.
Mm-hmm.
And here's our sustainability officer, and here's the blah, blah, blah. And I raise my hand and say, has anyone here read the Texas Public Policy Foundation white paper on how this is a violation, potentially, of antitrust law, fiduciary law, tortious interference with contract, consumer protection.
I've been specifically focused more on the S than on the E.
Right.
Because they are pushing for the adoption in almost every industry by America's really most iconic companies and brands of illegal discriminatory policies. But again, and it's not like these companies are trying to hide that's what they're doing. They put on their websites their annual DEI report. That's another set of initials. Diversity, equity,
and inclusion. And by the way, when Dan says unlawful, he doesn't mean criminal necessarily. This could also mean against the law, okay?
Right.
It could mean civil. In other words, the kind of thing for which you get fined.
We passed the first Civil Rights Act in 1866. That's the 14th Amendment was written to constitutionalize that act.
Yeah.
Ever since then, it has been illegal for anyone in America to make contracting decisions based on race. And yet, how many corporations have you read about in the last week?
The last week.
That have been doing so.
Right. Okay.
It's
hold
a
that
long
thought.
List.
He's telling me I have no choice but to go to break. I'm talking to Dan Morinoff. He's executive director at the American Civil Rights Project. I'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Dan Morinoff, executive director over at the American Civil Rights Project. Where we left off is we're talking about ESG investment criteria, environmental, social, and governance, which is not a legally defined term. No one can agree what this means, but large financial institutions are willing to harm American companies by not lending money to them if they don't meet their standards for environmental policy, social policy, or governance. We left off on civil rights.
Can I throw one thing at you? Though?
Yes, please.
You're right. I mean, there are a couple international bodies that are trying to define what exactly this means. To be honest, the ambiguity is probably the best thing that you can say about ESG. But to the extent that it's just word clouds of nonsense, then, you know, it's probably being used to defraud investors who are being promised that this has some actual content. But from my perspective, if it doesn't really have any content, then it's a whole lot less destructive than what I think it actually is.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like hope and change.
Yeah.
I mean, what does it mean to you? Is anyone really against hope and change? Is anyone really against environmental policy or social policy or, you know,
right.
It deflects all criticism because no one knows what it is,
right.
For starters. So you can't draw a target on it because you don't even know what you're targeting.
Right. Except for the fact that we kind of know from watching what they're actually doing and how they're pursuing this.
You'd have to be Dan Mornoff. You have to be paying attention really closely to know what's going on, because most people just hear, oh, environmental, social, and governance. Well, of course I want to invest in things I believe in and that square with my values. And, right. and by the way, that's great.
The Society for Niceness and Justice.
Yeah.
How nice.
You know what? I feel like everyone should invest in what they believe in. And if you want to go outside and set your money on fire by investing in things that make you feel great, I don't care. It's none of my business. And I'm not against it. But when you're talking about people's pension funds, or when you're selling a product and you don't disclose that, in fact, what we're calling green isn't really green.
Yeah.
This is the problem. And apparently, you know, I've heard from certain people in this space that what they're trying to do is appeal to millennials or Generation Z. So the millennials are about to inherit a ton of money yeah. from the generation that's dying off. And they, which is another reason why inherited wealth is a really bad idea. But there they go. And so they're going to invest in things that make them feel good. They are socially responsible, right? So they're young, they're inexperienced. An investment manager says, it's green. Don't you want to invest in something green? And they say, of course.
Yeah.
And then, at least, I raised this with one of my investment guys. He's like, oh, I've got this ESG fund. I'm like, whoa. You don't listen to the Jackie Daly Show. I said, I am not doing that. Yeah. There's nothing you can say to change my mind. He's like, well, don't you believe in, you know, women's rights on boards? And I'm like, yes, of course I do. But I went through all the reasons why I don't believe that they actually are more diverse. I've seen some articles in some credible publications yeah. laying out how things that are advertised as environmental, social, or governance are not environmentally friendly, are not, in fact, diverse, and are not any better in governance. So I'm not sure I buy the foundational claim.
Sweden passed a law a lot like California's. They didn't repeal it, and their courts didn't block it. And if I'm remembering this right, within 10 years, I think it was, the number of publicly traded companies in the country had reduced by half. Corporations, the government there was very proud to announce that publicly traded corporations had a much higher percentage of their directorships held by women. They did not mention that the total number of directorships held by women had not increased because half the companies had gone private in order to ignore the law. Yeah, it just
unbelievable. Yeah. That's a perfect example of the story behind the story that you never get. And some fact checker would call you a liar right now. If you tried to say, oh, this law didn't do any good for women, you'd be fact checked. And they'd say, well, in fact, the percentage of board seats held by women is higher.
And I would tell them, yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, it did. That's a true statement
right.
that doesn't tell you anything.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. So, okay, back to civil rights.
Right.
A friend of mine sent a note to me yesterday on this billionaire whose name I now forget. It doesn't matter. Big Biden donor has a tech company and sent a letter to all of his employees saying, you know,
Twillo.
There you go.
Yeah.
We're going to lay a lot of people off. And man, I hate it. But don't worry. We're going to do so consistent with our anti-racist, anti-oppression policies. And one of my friends,
social justice,
said, oh, it was one of them said, well, you know what this means. They're discriminating against white people. And I said, you know what? I'm not sure. I actually think this statement, since I know that a lot of these people are phonies, it might just be a CYA so that they don't get sued people.
They will be sued. They will be sued because they've... I mean, you might be right that he's lying, but people fired in the... I hate the phrase protected class because that isn't how our laws work.
Right.
Our laws don't protect any one group. They protect people, Americans, from being discriminated against on the basis of race, on the basis of sex. So when you announce we're handling our mass layoff through an
anti-oppression
lens. Right. Take your pick. Whatever the phraseology was. No, that's what that is a facial announcement of a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Yeah.
There is no question that's what that is.
Well, and so this is a guy who said this. Surely he ran it through legal.
I doubt it.
Really?
He might have. Who knows? I mean, one of our larger projects that we have underway is that we are sending demands on behalf of shareholders to the officers and directors of very large iconic corporations saying, funny thing, you've admitted to violating American civil rights laws. Here are the federal ones. Here are some state ones that you've also violated. And you don't get to do that with my money.
Right.
Right. So you can bet the farm that maybe what you think is a good idea is legal, but you can't bet my farm.
Right.
That's a different,
that's
a different
exactly
question.
Right.
Right. So we've argued in every state we've looked at, this is true. And normally when shareholders want to complain about something that their officers and directors are doing, it's a hard thing to do because almost everyone can say, yeah, you know, I started selling duck socks, but I really thought people wanted those. And it might be an absolutely idiotic idea.
Was it in the business judgment rule, Dan?
But that's exactly where I was going. Like, yeah. If it was a reasonable exercise of your business judgment, courts will not second guess you.
Right.
But there is this one exception to the business judgment rule, which is, did you adopt a policy that's illegal? The way the Delaware courts describe this is, we don't charter lawbreakers. We don't care if breaking the law is very profitable. I like to think of it this way. If I'm investing in a pharmacy,
right,
and the pharmacy decides, you know, selling people prescription medications, it's okay, but I think I'd make a lot more money if I started selling crack too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I get to say something about that as an investor. Like, right. It doesn't matter if you're right. You might be right. I still get to stop you from doing that because it's obvious. It's obviously illegal. The state, this whole system doesn't exist for you to take my money and bet on no one following up on a facial violation of the law.
Yeah, right.
So we actually just filed suit against the officers and directors of Starbucks because they have a whole collection of policies that I think are obviously facially illegal. Among them, they're shifting $700 million of their supply contracts based on the race of ownership of their suppliers.
Whoa.
They're shifting 15% of their media buy on the based on the race of the ownership of their counterparties.
Uh-huh.
These are not close calls.
No.
You know, there are also a bunch of stuff that's employment based, which, you know, we can talk about.
Well, and isn't this, let me stop you for just a second. Mm-hmm. Even that, aren't they saying that they're going to go to companies that have, let's say, a person, a racial minority in a key position? But it doesn't mean that that company is like,
their threshold
minority
is 51% owned by,
okay,
laundry list of favored races,
okay,
sexes, ethnicities, and genders.
Okay. Tim Ford.
Yeah.
Okay, that clears it up for me. What's going on here? All right. So so if you're 49%, you don't qualify. You're
correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Tim Ford. So there we are with, I guess, you know, 19 attorneys general going after BlackRock for antitrust, which is, you know, one thing. Here we're talking about civil rights, which is a lot easier for people to grasp. Right. I think that I'm trying to talk about what the attorneys general are doing. To me, this is so exciting.
Yeah.
Because finally someone's getting on it, and it's not just like an Exxon. It's 19 the chief law enforcement officers of states. But this, you're biting off because it's a lot more manageable. For a firm your size, you're a nonprofit.
Yeah, I mean, this is how I would describe this and why I think this matters. Look, I think there's a massive disconnect between the costs and benefits of officers and directors doing illegal things. When they bet with my money that no one cares that they're discriminating against white people and Asians, men, cisgendered, whatever, right? When they make that bet, they get all of the social benefits. They are buying social credit with my money. On the other hand, all of the costs are handled. Well, they're not their costs. I mean, say you're the director of a director of Starbucks. If this blows up, you're an independent director. You aren't a material shareholder. How does that impact you? It doesn't impact you at all.
I have an insurance policy if you come against me, and I'm not going to lose money.
So here's what I like. No, you're right. They don't lose their own money.
Yeah,
they
lose
the company's money. And
yeah,
like if other people, and we're doing this on behalf of shareholders, not on behalf of the people they're discriminating against. If one of those suppliers of Starbucks sues Starbucks, which they will, and they'll win. When they do, who pays? Starbucks pays. The shareholders pay.
Right.
And given that I'll bet you 20 to 40% of Starbucks equity is in the hands of, oh, I don't know, because I do, you know, does that make any difference whatsoever to the officers and directors? No.
Right.
Their position is safe if they've done this.
On the
other hand, the shareholders lose. So the shareholders, when we do something about this, though, we're not suing Starbucks. We're suing you, the officer and director who decided to adopt, implement, and retain, knowing it was illegal, these facially discriminatory policies.
Okay.
And if we're right that it's a violation of your duties to the company and outside your authorization as a matter of corporate law, then you pay, and it is you. You're right. Every large company has an officers and directors insurance policy. What's nice about this? The policy can't cover this. If we're right, this is an intentional violation of law. No insurer is paying damages for an intentional violation of law. That's on you.
It's similar to committing a crime. They don't cover you for committing fraud.
Right. Exactly. Same thing. So you know. So. We think that that's a really important difference in this kind of litigation because it means that when they lose, the money comes out of them, you personally. And, you know, let's jump ahead and let's assume this works, which I think it will. Obviously, I'm the one doing it. Of course, I'm going to tell you that. Let's assume this works. If this works and we start taking away people's yachts, you do that to enough of the plutocrats who sit on these boards and other boards. By the way, the chairman of the board of Starbucks is also a member of the board of directors of JP Morgan Chase, who we've also written to.
Uh-huh.
In that capacity, she and I are becoming pen pals. but like, right, I'm sorry. In any case, though, it will change the decision-making calculus of C-suites across America once people start losing their vacation homes.
Right on.
Like, if this is actually on you, if we reconnect the cost with the cost-benefit analysis and make people actually weigh, do I care that I'm adopting something that's obviously illegal? Then I think you might actually see corporate America change its tune and come back into adherence with longstanding civil law and the morality, the settled moral position of the American people.
Makes sense to me. I'm talking to Dan Morinoff, and he's the executive director of the American Civil Rights Project. Thanks, Dan Morinoff. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.